Hello, everyone. Good evening. Hello and welcome to this evening's event, Explore Everything. My name is Sandra Sikorova. I'm the curator of public programs here at Tate Modern. And it's my great pleasure to introduce this evening's event and its speakers, Bradley Garrett and Ian Borden. This event coincides with the publication of Explore Everything, Place Hacking in the City by Bradley Garrett, released earlier this month by Verso Books. You have a chance to purchase your own copy in the adjacent space after the event and have it also signed by the author after this event. I would also like to thank our partners Verso for their support with organizing this event. This is the third event in a collaborative series that we've been doing, introducing kind of radical thinkers, bringing them into the space and opening up a public debate. And we look forward to kind of reconvening again in next spring with follow-up events. So, Explore Everything is a book about urban exploration, recreational trespass in the built environment. It narrates the rise and fall of the London Consolidation Crew, UK's most famous and notorious place hackers, with whom the author spent 4 years taking part in more than 300 trespass events in 8 countries with over 100 explorers. Alongside storytelling, Bradley offers an analysis of the politics of urban exploration, the effective role of photography and video, and the phenomenology of urban flow. Bradley Garrett is a writer, explorer, filmmaker, photographer, and researcher at the School of Geography and the Environment at University of Oxford. With an academic background in anthropology, history, and maritime archaeology, Bradley has worked for several years as a heritage consultant and archaeologist for the U.S. Bureau of Land Management and several Native American tribes. In 2012, Bradley completed his PhD at Royal Holloway, University of London. His doctoral research was a visual ethnography with urban explorers, which resulted in the book that we're here to talk about. Bradley will be in conversation with Ian Borden, who is a professor of architecture and urban culture at the Ballard School of Architecture at UCL, where he's also the vice dean for communications. His books include Drive, Journeys Through Film, Cities and Landscapes, published by Reaction in 2012, and Famous Skateboarding, Space and the City, Architecture and Body, published by Burke in 2001. This evening, Bradley will discuss his practice, inviting us to critically engage with questions around public and private, spatial politics, urban life, the increased surveillance and control over our urban environments, offering us a radically new way of thinking and engaging with our environment. Finally, with regards to the format of the event, Bradley will talk about his practice for 15 minutes, show us some imagery as well to illustrate his practice, followed by an in-conversation with Ian, and around 7:30 we'll open up to Q&A. So that's about it. After the event, you'll have a chance to purchase the book if you haven't done so already, and have it signed by Bradley. Now, please join me in welcoming Bradley, who will start his presentation. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the introduction, Sandra, and thank you, everyone, for being here, and Ian, for coming along tonight to speak with me. I thought what I'd do tonight, given Ian's work on architecture and the ways in which we co-opt and reinterpret architecture through practices like skateboarding and driving, I thought it'd be worth beginning by drawing some parallels between the building that we're sitting in here and Battersea Power Station. As some of you may know, both of these buildings were designed by Sir Giles Gilbert Scott, yet the lives of these two buildings have taken quite different trajectories over the past 20 years. Bankside Power Station was derelict from 1981 to 2000 when it was redeveloped into this wonderful cultural space. And Battersea Power Station, derelict since 1983, just a few years after Bankside, is still a ruin today and currently under redevelopment. And I want to argue that Battersea, in its state as a ruin, is an equally interesting and important cultural space. And I think this was evident during Open House Weekend just a few weeks ago, when thousands of people queued up to see the interior of the building. And part of this fascination is from stories we know, stories like the pink pig being floated between the chimneys for the Pink Floyd Animals album cover, which detached itself from the chimneys and floated into the Heathrow flight path. And I guess, you know, also the, its sort of appearance in various films, which have made us more familiar with the building. But I think part of the allure of Battersea Power Station is in what Edward Hollis has called the secret lives of buildings. So I want to tell you some secrets about Battersea. In 2008, my friends and I were standing here on the bank of the Thames looking at the building, and we were talking about how it's ironic that it's such a cultural icon. This is a building that a lot of people have attachment to, yet it's been sitting there derelict for over 20 years, almost wholly unvisited. And we wanted to know what was inside. So it seemed that, you know, the easiest solution to satisfy that curiosity, the most obvious way, was just to sneak in. So we did. We snuck in at 2 a.m., we jumped over the fences, we snuck past the security guards, and inside we found these control rooms, which were in an amazing state of preservation. And we realized that while we were in here, we could do whatever we wanted, right? There were no guides or interpreters, there were no glass cases, there were no opening hours. And so, you know, we ran around in this control room and we spun wheels and we turned levers and we played with the space and, you know, pretended to shut down power to bits of London. We pulled out and marveled at these blueprints from a 70-year-old file when Battersea only had two chimneys. So for a night, Battersea was transformed into a living archive. So this is urban exploration. It's the practice of researching, scoping, and sneaking into places that you're not supposed to have access to. And in the first book on urban exploration from 2005, it was described as an interior tourism that allows the curious-minded to discover a world of behind-the-scenes sites. These behind-the-scenes sites include derelict industrial buildings, closed hospitals, abandoned military installations, sewer and drain networks, transportation and utility tunnels, shuttered businesses, foreclosed estates, mines, construction sites, bridges, cranes, bunkers. The list could go on. Now, the places on that list, at first glance, seem quite disparate. However, one attribute they all share is that they're off limits to the vast majority of the population. In order to access them, you have to find a security loophole and exploit it. You have to hack the architecture. So I'm sure some of you will have run across photos like these online at some point. This one is from Millennium Mills. It's just next to London City Airport. This is an abandoned flour mill from the early 1900s. And throughout this financial crisis, photos of places like this have become more and more ubiquitous. And whilst they conjure up an aesthetic grammar of their own now, they're also, I would argue, situated in a history of body-environment-art relations. Now, keeping in mind that many of these ruins, including Battersea Power Station, as I mentioned, will be have been knocked down or heavily changed through redevelopment, these photos have been described as a kind of guerrilla archaeology, a rogue survey. But I think what explorers are trying to relay in these photos is also a sense of place and a sense of pace that complicates our notion of what constitutes the city. Being in places like this inspires a kind of patient curiosity that I think really comes through in the photography. But also, given the sense of the temporal captured through these long exposures, the photos raise questions about photography's ability to do more than document a moment, and to rather evoke an event, to cause us to wonder what's taking place outside of the frame. In short, photos like this are sort of bursting with affective qualities and associations. However, I think this is worth complicating a bit. Across the Atlantic in Detroit, which has now become a sort of a ruined mecca in the United States, You find the remains of the automotive industry, mills, churches, hospitals, and schools. They're extensive. But we find distinct differences in the socio-political constitution of ruined space. I think ruins here, more than in England, are a part of people's everyday lives. Their living space, their play space, and they invoke specters of the past in ways perhaps less tinged with nostalgia. Problematically, urban explorers like myself have sort of parachuted into the city to document its decay in a long tradition that really stretches back through Romanticism. And of course, you know, we're doing that now through photography rather than painting. But what we had done by photographing this city is we represented it as dead and empty and devoid of life, to the dismay of Detroit residents, many of whom decried these depictions as ruin porn. So I'll return to the imagery at the end of this talk, but I think I'd just like that idea to sit with you while I talk to you about some different kinds of spaces. The idea that the ethics and politics behind ruin exploration are as much about the social and cultural context of material remains as they are about the desire to cross boundaries. These images should be and are challenged where they're shared devoid of any contextual information about the circumstances that lead to ruination. But I have to say, through my experiences as an urban explorer, I found that sympathetic associations with other times, other people, and other places are inevitable when you wander through places like this derelict Packard automotive plant in Detroit. You can't help but wonder how much suffering is embedded in the architecture, despite the inherent beauty of the aesthetics of decay. So, after 2 years of exploring derelict places like this with my friends in London, Paris, Barcelona, Detroit, and Berlin, it was a conversation along these lines that caused us in 2010 to want to return to London and to rethink our practice. And we came back determined to sort of crack this city open in ways that had never been done before by urban explorers, to reveal some of London's best kept secrets. And in the process, we made the move from ruin exploration to infrastructural exploration. And one of the first places that we looked to was London's sewer system. So this sewer is not far from where you're sitting now. It's 150 years old, and it's still functioning despite the occasional leak and fatberg. And it's beautifully built with a Victorian attention to detail that we seem to have forgotten. And even though many of you may walk over sewers like this every day on your way to work, on your way home, it's not likely that many of you have seen one. Accessing them, however, if you would believe it, requires little more than pulling open a manhole and going down there. It's not that difficult. So the boundaries to accessing the hidden city, I want to make clear here, are more conceptual than physical. So from the sewers, we found our way into pipe subways and cable runs all over London. This is where our telecommunications, fiber optics, and gas pipes are laid. There are dozens of miles of these all over the city, and this one in particular, again, is not very far from us. This runs from Blackfriars, basically to Parliament. And if you look, there's a Boudicca statue across from Parliament and Westminster Station, and there's a door in the plinth of that statue. If you look in the grill on that door, you'll actually see the inside of these tunnels. And I would encourage you, after you leave here, to go and take that walk. It's not very far. Walk down there. You'll actually see the tunnels. You can look through the grills on the embankment as well, and you'll see the tunnels underneath the grills. Now, this is where it gets really exciting. We took tube maps from 1932, and we compared them to tube maps from 2012, and we realized that a number of stations were missing from the new map. We thought that those stations might still be there, and so we started running the tracks at night to find them. And eventually, as a group, we made it into all 14 intact ghost stations on the London Underground, and we posted photos of them online so that everyone could sort of share in the discovery of these places, or the rediscovery of these places. this particular station is obviously Aldwych. It used to be called Strand Station. It's on a sort of dead branch of the Piccadilly line. And this was only closed down in 1994, so some of you may have actually used this station. TfL does open this station up a few times a year for tours because they also use it for filming purposes. So that's actually a 1972 Northern Line train that they've stabled in there for filming purposes. But if you ever get the chance to take the tour, you should go. It's really interesting. I didn't take this on the tour, by the way. The lights are always on, strangely. Yeah. So, speaking of the lights being on, in our final sort of underground mystery here, I want to take you into the London Mail Rail. This is a 6.5 mile system of subterranean railway between Paddington and Whitechapel. It was built in 1926, and the post office used to use this railway to move post across the city, so it's connected to various sorting stations. In 2003, they mothballed the mail rail. They decided that it wasn't no longer economically viable. And it was largely unseen until 2011, when we found our way in and the BBC published our photos. So inside here, there were these tiny trains called Mini Yorks that they used to transport the post across the city. And they were now, of course, all immobile. And the thing that was really interesting about the mail rail is that after only a decade, the tunnels were already calcifying. They were filling with stalactites and stalagmites. And you could easily imagine the mail rail in 100 years beginning to look like a natural cave with old postal bags and trains being sucked into the walls and a river running down the tracks. But it's worth keeping in mind, of course, that when thinking about the hidden city, our ever-expanding vertical imaginations stack as well as tunnel. So this building in the front should look familiar. Over 4 years, we climbed onto rooftops of the British Museum, the Olympic Stadium, St. Paul's Cathedral, and almost every major under-construction skyscraper in the city: Strata, the walkie-talkie, Eagle House, the Cheese Grater, St. George's Wharf, 100 Middlesex Street, Heron Tower, Lantern Court, New Court, and then, of course, the Shard, which some of you may have seen in the papers last year. Our ascent of the Shard was nowhere near as daring as the Greenpeace protesters earlier this year. But the beautiful thing about our explorations is that no one knew we had been in there until we posted the photos 6 months later. So in my last few minutes here, I just want to really try and push this conversation into some areas that I think will be productive for discussion now that you're a bit more familiar with the kinds of spaces we've gone into. The first thing I want to do is to expand upon my notion of place hacking. If you think about the ways cities are currently built, it's not hard to realize that aside from open house weekend, perhaps, the vast majority of the city is closed to us. And when the city is opened up, it almost always comes at a cost. And what's more, the few small spaces that do seem to be popularly owned, like the South Bank skate park, which Ian knows quite well, seem to be constantly under threat by economic imperatives undermining our desires for public space and freedom to move about in the city on our own terms. So my solution here, just like at Battersea, is a simple one. Where space is closed, we open it. Hacking has always been an elective procedure of participation in otherwise closed objects, whether referring to proprietary cyberspace or off-limits architecture. And trespassing makes private space public space, even temporarily, and that's a powerful idea. So let me take you back now to Battersea Power Station, where earlier this year we reimagined what was possible there yet again and actually scaled the chimneys themselves. And my final point is this. We don't just democratize space through action, but also through documentation and dissemination. And given that we're all sitting here in an art gallery, it would be crazy not to recognize the force of the images we've created during these interventions. As Ian's colleague Jane Rendell has written, imaginative spaces are created through photography, where images are an invitation to imagine other possibilities. And like the situationists of 1950s Paris, we as urban explorers are primarily purveyors of experience. And I'm not showing you these photos nor did I write the book to impress you with our accomplishments. What I want to do here is to encourage you to play with the imagery and to become a part of the political matter of the city on whatever terms you feel you need to. In order to make space into place, we cannot just act. We also need to extend invitation through doing exactly what I'm doing right now, standing here, appealing to you to respond to these images. I'd like to invite Ian up to respond to these images for the next 20 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up to the audience. Thanks very much.
Welcome, everyone. Well, thank you, Bradley. Thank you for really interesting insight into your practices, and particularly welcome the comments about imagery, which I think everyone agrees is some of the most, I think, striking aspects of urban exploring. And I think for many people in the room, certainly myself, apart from hearing odd rumours of this strange activity, it really kind of burst into consciousness when actually seeing pictures on the front page of Metro or the Evening Standard or some, you know, other newspapers, certainly in London. So I'd like to ask you about that. But before we do talk about imagery, I suppose what I wanted to just ask a little bit about was the comments that you made about things like the ghost stations.
Yeah.
Or the mail rail underneath London, because Battersea Power Station, which are not spaces which are unknown.
Right.
I'm an architectural historian by kind of training, so maybe I've got a little bit more of an eye for some of these strange, quirky places. Some of you may know this fabulous book called London Under London by Trench, which, you know, documents some of these places. So they're not, you know, in a way, they're not completely unknown, but they're known to exist, but people don't experience them and are not part of our everyday lives. So one of the comments that you make in the book is that when you're exploring things like this, that in a way there's a journey into those places, but there's also a journey into ourselves and into a sort of a need to discover places. Yeah. So I suppose what my question is to what degree are you trying to get into places because they're unknown?
Right.
But to what extent are you trying to tap into a kind of a need for discovery or a need to explore that's actually within the self? So I guess the question is it an exploration of the self as well as of the place that you're going
yeah,
into?
Yeah, no, it most certainly is. I think all of us, certainly as we're growing up, when we're children, we explore the environment we live in. This is something that's built into us as human beings. And if you, for instance, live next to a hill, yeah, it's expected that at some point you're going to climb that hill, or if you've got a tree in your yard, that you're going to climb the tree and you're going to want to see the view from the top. When we transport that to an urban environment, all of a sudden it becomes threatening that we would want to see the view from the top of a building, or we'd want to see the tunnels that are underneath our house. I think that's a perfectly natural curiosity. And the thing that strikes me is not that urban explorers want to do these things, or that urban explorers do these things, but that most other people don't.
But actually, I think they probably do.
Right.
I think one of the reasons why this has become so interesting and so, if you like, popular, at least vicariously through the images, is because I think they tap into a fact that people, well, they may not do it actually,
right,
but they might want to do it. I mean, you know, one of the things that you do is obviously climb up tall buildings, and have an amazing view from the top. Now, lots of people enjoy going up tall buildings and seeing the view from the top. They may not take quite the same route as you do.
Yeah.
They go up the middle of the building rather than up the outside of it.
Yeah,
but sometimes
most people wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah,
sure.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I'm.
That was really stressful.
Yeah, I can imagine. I get stressed with just looking at an image like that. So
that's all that's holding me up, that little rope.
But nonetheless, I think there is a desire of people to investigate these places. So you talked about open house, which has
been
phenomenally popular phenomenon, because you get to go in all these places that ordinarily you wouldn't go into, or you think that you don't normally have access into.
Yeah.
So there does seem to me there's this kind of, you're tapping into this desire of people to want to explore, or possibly, asking the question in a slightly different way, that they should have the right to be able to access other places, either through legitimate means or perhaps vicariously through transgressive means.
Well, that's exactly what I think the images do. I mean, the images do a particular type of work in opening out, as I said, the kind of imaginative spaces of the city. Yeah. And when these images started circulating, we got a lot of emails from people who were fascinated with the explorations. A lot of people who were absolutely uninterested in doing this type of thing, but were thankful that we had done it. Not just that we had done it, but that we had shared the experience. Yeah. And I think that the other thing that's important to say here is that there are people who explore the city in different ways. They explore the city on their own terms. So that might be, you know, taking a different route to work. Yeah. That might be attending open house weekend and making sure that every year you block off those 2 days and you go see as much as you possibly can. I did that the other weekend. Yeah. You know, I went to the excavations for Crossrail at Canary Wharf. I went to the Stratford Depot. It was incredible to be able to see those places. And I think, you know, honestly, it diffused my desire to explore them. The thing that really struck me, though, is that, I mean, in particular, Battersea Power Station, the queues were enormous to get in there. And there was this
real... On Open House.
On Open House weekend, yeah. But there was this real sense of frustration, I think, with the people who had sort of queued up all day and weren't able to get in, particularly because they know that if this place is redeveloped, they're never going to see it in this state again.
Okay.
And that's what they want to see. They want to see the derelict icon, you know. They don't want to walk through the shopping mall that it's going to become.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that raises another sort of issue about this, which is the degree to which, you know, there's a sense of capturing a world which is disappearing. Mm. I mean, one of the things that struck me in reading the book, and for those of you that haven't had a chance to read it yet, Bradley takes us on a kind of an extraordinary kind of journey in time. We kind of start at the beginning and move through a period of a few years till we get pretty much to the present. But it's largely set, therefore, in a world of the world global recession.
Yeah.
That it's, you know, it kind of coincides with a kind of, not quite an apocalypse, but certainly a fairly serious era in recent contemporary socioeconomic conditions. And I wonder to what degree it's an exploration that could only have happened, but particularly happened coincidentally with a moment where perhaps there are buildings which are not being rapidly turned over, that they're not quite as quickly being redeveloped, and that, you know, that it's a period of years. You refer to it as a golden age few times, and I'm not sure. If that, you know, if that's because, you know, just because of the moment of the LCC and the London construction crew and the way that has developed and perhaps has closed down now, but all it's to do with the golden age of when this was possible, whereas it might not be possible now.
No, I mean, obviously, you know, pitching this period of time as a golden age, that's in the book. It's sort of in terms of the golden age of exploration in London when we were able to sort of reveal all these spaces, but. You know, in the context of the global financial crisis, it all begins to look a bit morbid, you know, that we're sort of exploring the you know, other people's actual economic failures and the bankruptcies. I mean, there was one crane that was just above Aldgate East Station that was owned by an Icelandic company. And when the Icelandic economy collapsed, the whole thing just shut down. But of course, they left the crane there.
You're left with a wonderful structure.
Yeah, but there was no security or anything because there was just no investment for the place. And, you know, we had a great time there. We went there, you know, probably a dozen times. I actually wrote bits of the book sitting in the crane cab. It was the most incredible view. But I see now that construction has sort of kick-started again. Someone's bought the property, and it's changing again. And, you know, there was something. I think this is what triggered the moment. Kind of halfway through the book, when we started, you know, really critically thinking about what it meant to explore these ruins and the fact that, you know, people had suffered because, and that's why these spaces existed. So I think that, you know, that kind of triggered the move into infiltration.
It's certainly something that you also get when you show pictures of places that are of other forms of disaster, you know, I use the word disaster, but they're places of economies which have failed. Sometimes they're mental health asylums or hospitals where, you know, there's a sense, which have since closed down, so there's a sense of kind of pathos and a sense of kind of ruined lives and forgotten lives, that there's a, therefore a whole kind of resonance of a sort of ruins of buildings, but also ruins of societies that have, or sections of societies that have come by hard times. Yeah. And there's a really kind of powerful emotional attachment or impact that you get through the images into those worlds as well. And I was very struck by that. How much that you know, it's not, we'll get onto it, but it's not all kind of climbing up the shard of places of spectacle, but actually they're places of real quite kind of intimacy and poignancy that you're investigating through
that. Well, that's what we found in Detroit, but it was also what we found in Eastern Europe. We spent a lot of time sort of from Berlin into Poland exploring abandoned remains of the Soviet Union, and we found a couple of military bases there. There was one just outside of Potsdam called Vogelsang, and the place was in the middle of a forest. At one point, there were 12,000 Soviet troops stationed at this base, and we spent days wandering around there. And sometimes we would go into these places and we would find local people in there kind of smashing things up, mm-hmm. which, you know, we couldn't imagine someone doing that in Battersea Power Station, but that's because it's tinged with this nostalgia. Yeah. And for them, it was a catharsis, really, to go into these spaces and smash things up. And I think, you know, that was...
As an act against the previous regime? Is that...
I think so, yeah. I think that there was some residual frustration there that people needed to unleash on the architecture. And, you know, and we started thinking, well, who are we to judge if they want to smash up the ruins in their local neighborhood? It's not something we would do to Battersea Power Station, but that's really what made us think we need to bring this back home because it started feeling like we were making incursions into other people's memories and other people's spaces that actually began to feel a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah. The another kind of site that you investigate, which you talk about with the mail rail and the forgotten stations of London, or the largely forgotten stations of London, is another kind of hidden world, which is the kind of the hidden world of infrastructure, the kind of the hidden world of logic, the hidden world of kind of where the cables run and where the tracks run, things that we kind of instinctively know that exist, but. You know, aren't kind of bubbling up into our surface, and that struck me as something else that you know, this kind of exploration does is to sort of unearth or project the different logics of the city, which otherwise would not be apparent.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that did become apparent through exploring infrastructure. I mean, these are simple questions like, when you flush your toilet, where does it go?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and finding that out is not that difficult. You walk out, you find the manhole in your street, you open it up, you go down there, and then you sort of find it. There's actually this wonderful passage that I found from the 1850s by a guy called John Hollingshead. He was commissioned by Charles Dickens to go into the London sewers, and he went to a sewer underneath his house, and he said that watching the sewage pour out of there felt like he had opened a trap door to his chest.
Yeah.
I thought it was a great passage, but while we were spending time in the sewers and in the cable runs, it occurred to me that, you know, this is the urban body. You know, this is how it's all connected. This is where the electricity flows, this is where the sewage connects, this is where the storm drains are dumping into. And actually, we were sort of wandering through the veins and arteries of the city and very much becoming a part of the city in a way that we hadn't experienced before. And I think, you know, to me, that was the most powerful thing about exploring, was feeling that there was this meld happening, that all of a sudden we were part of the urban constitution in a really fundamental way.
Mm. So, you know, one of the reasons why I keep thinking of urban exploring, not only as something which you engage in, but also that other people would be interested in. But, you know, one logic of it is that, therefore, that people in, you know, reading the accounts, seeing the things online, seeing the photographs, as they get access to those worlds. But I suppose thinking about it, another reason is that, you know, perhaps other people might feel that they can, it gives them the right not to know, because other people are taking on the job of doing the knowing.
Yeah.
That it's a bit like a monument to the fallen of war, soldiers who've died. That in a way, the function of those monuments is to allow you to forget to enable to park the memory over somewhere else so that you don't have to constantly remember. So, you know, maybe these things to some extent are a kind of a relinquishing that we don't have to fully always understand where the power comes from or where the water goes or where your poo goes to when you flush the toilet because someone else is doing it, that job. I mean, in a similar way, I think that some of the reasons why, I'm trying to think why, you know, why do we all love seeing pictures, or I think most people like seeing pictures of you climbing up the Shard or of Heron Tower or some of these kind of rather different kind of not infrastructural, very visible, you know, hugely symbolic icons of contemporary capitalism, is to see, in a way, the a single person kind of being able to appropriate and seize that and gain some control over it.
Yeah, I mean, a part of what I think these photos do is they make the impossible possible.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that people who look at the photos are going to go and do these things. Again, it's sort of, they can look at it and just sort of take comfort in the fact that, you know, you can get away with this if you wanted to.
Yeah.
But I mean, part of this obviously is also, you know, there's a lot of performativity in these photos. So often what we're documenting is are spaces which are going to be lost, which have moved on. And so, you know, we create, I mean, not just a record of the place, it's not just pure documentation, but it's a record of an unfolding of an event and a documentation of a period of time where you can imagine these sort of groups of people going out at night and you know, going on these sort of nocturnal forays into the city to collect all of this imagery. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that the images work that's quite interesting is actually as bookmarks to these experiences.
Yeah.
And they're not saying, oh, let's be nostalgic about this hospital that has now been knocked down that we photographed, but they're saying, you know, if we could do this then, you can do this now.
Yeah.
Let's keep the adventure going.
One of the interesting things about the book is that you don't identify or exactly where the places are. I mean, you can kind of tell because they run alongside the narrative, and you can tell that it's, you know, it's probably this building in Detroit and it's probably that. But unless you know, and particularly if it's outside of a city that I don't know Detroit very well, so I was asking Bradley beforehand, you know, what's that building? What's that one?
Yeah.
You know, but in a way, it doesn't. Does it not matter what the buildings are? Is it more about the, as you say, the conceptual experience rather than necessarily, you know, that it's on top of that tower or within that power station? That it's more the, as I keep saying earlier, the sense of discovery and the conceptual nature, as you said, of uncovering and accessing a city that perhaps normally would not be accessible.
Yeah, well, the imagery is meant to inspire and to encourage. I want people to look at it and wonder where it is and you know, to think outside the frame. My background was in archaeology, and I was actually, when I began this project, I was thinking of urban exploration as a kind of survey, you know, this kind of photo documentation of places, and that we were creating archives that would be useful. And it was actually through the course of the project that I began to realize that this is not what explorers were doing at all. They, part of it is about documentation, but part of it is also about just creating little sort of points of rupture in the world, little kind of interesting moments that you can latch onto that will encourage you to kind of pull the string and see where it goes.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, eventually when I did put the images in the book, we had a bit of a debate with Leo Hollis, my editor. We sat down and thought about what, you know, how we were going to do this. And I said, I don't think we should put captions in there because I think, you know, that inspires the same kind of curiosity that going into these places does when you don't have a clue what these artifacts are and you're just sort of, you know, you're feeling your way through it.
Yeah, it's really interesting because in a way, it's the whole book is a kind of journey. It's like you enter into this rather strange world, and you know, to some extent you come out the other side, although you may be rather changed through doing it. I mean, I suppose one of the other things, and you do discuss this in the book, but it might be worth just airing it a bit here, though, is the degree to which the images, I can imagine, are probably somewhat controversial within the urban exploring communities, because the moment you put something online, it can close down a place. It can become, I think you used the term hot, that that it becomes a place which is difficult to access.
Yeah.
And so the images may work conceptually to open up bits of rupture and the idea of opening up the city. But for that particular spot,
yeah,
they may work the other way round and close it off. I think you talk in the book about effectively it being a race to get round all the different ghost stations underneath London, and that's partly because you're posting descriptions, but were you also posting images of those at the same time?
Yeah, we were. I think nowhere was that more evident than the Shard. We were told that after our images went online, there was one security guard at the Shard when we snuck in there. And, you know, we were standing on the bridge and watching him wander around through the yard, and then he went in his little hut, and then we knew, okay, this is our moment. Luckily, he wasn't watching the cameras in the hut. But after we posted the photos online, we were told that they hired 12 more security guards. So no,
creating jobs for London.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Creating more jobs than Cameron.
Yeah. But it closed the, you know, to
yeah,
some extent.
It did sort of close down the site to a degree. So, I mean, there are ways that explorers have to sort of mitigate that. So one of the things that we do is we don't post the photos until a skyscraper has topped out.
Okay.
In other instances, like with the ghost stations, you know, TfL knew that we were exploring these stations and they weren't happy about it. But, you know, they were sort of watching us post one after another and probably trying to guess which station we were going to next. So then we would sort of mix it up. And, you know, luckily we got away with it. Yeah. But, the imagery, there's certainly are negative impacts to being vocal about what we do. But I think this also comes back to this question of whether or not exploration, I mean, what is this for? Is this a selfish navel-gazing exercise? Is this purely about our phenomenological experiences in the city and about what it is we want to get out of it? Or are we going to share these explorations? And are we going to, you know, put the invitation out there for people to, you know, not necessarily to get involved, but to understand and to have a conversation about it. And, you know, a lot of the explorers that I spent time with, they're not happy that I'm sitting here right now. They're not happy that I've published this book.
Yeah.
And I totally get that, and I respect it, and I appreciate it, and I understand it. But I think it's really important in a broader social context that we're actually here talking about it and what it means that we've done these things.
Yeah. I mean, it's partly something which is often said about any activity that is in some way transgressive or subversive, is that it takes its essence through remaining subversive and transgressive, and sometimes that means staying hidden and not being kind of outed to the world. When I wrote my book on skateboarding, which you mentioned, one of the things that I was very worried about was that it would be considered to be somehow, you know, talking about a practice was essentially a street-based practice in an arena that was no longer on the streets. It was in the world of academia or in public talks and so forth.
Yeah.
And that you're somehow then no longer remaining inside the practice that you're talking about. And I think one of the things that's, again, is really amazing about this book is the degree to which clearly this is not a book that's kind of written from the outside about urban exploring. It's a journey which is written, it is about urban exploring, but it's through the actual practice itself, which is a great part of the book. But the irony is that, of course, in the end, in the production of the book, it's then in the world of publishing and no longer in the actual practice of urban exploring.
Of course, yeah. I mean, I genuinely feel that ethnographic practice, you know, writing about a culture by being a part of the culture is absolutely essential. I mean, there are a lot of scholars who do work from sort of the outside in, and to me that feels a bit more like journalism, which is fine, but it's a different form of understanding. And I really wanted to understand urban exploration starting from the body, you know, to write the autoethnography.
So did you decide that you wanted to write about urban exploring and therefore became an urban explorer in order to do it? Or were you practicing urban exploring and thought, bloody hell, this is a good, you know, this
no,
is a
no,
great
it was,
thing.
No, it was quite interesting, actually, because I had just come off of sort of 5 years of working as an archaeologist. And one of the things that I got quite frustrated about being an archaeologist was the authority and control that I had over other people's narratives. So I was going into Native American communities and I was saying, oh yeah, this site here isn't interesting or significant. Don't worry about that one, you know, let the cattle graze on it. But this one over here, this is the one you should care about. And I was really uncomfortable being put in that position of authority. So when I came to start my PhD at Royal Holloway in 2008, I was quite interested in thinking about alternative archaeologies, about you know, local communities going out to define heritage on their own terms. So I had sort of three groups that I was interested in going out with. Urban explorers were one of them. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to hang out with mudlarkers, these people that are sort of digging around in the foreshore of the Thames to find artifacts, which archaeologists get really frustrated about on some occasions. And then these druids. I met this guy, Arthur Pendragon, who was occupying Stonehenge at the time, and I went and had coffee with him, and I thought, this is actually amazing. Like, what happens when you start occupying national monuments and sort of claiming them on behalf of the local population? But what happened, of course, is I went out with urban explorers a few times, and my supervisor, Tim Cresswell, he said, this is incredible. Yeah. Just go run with it. You know? Yeah. See how deep that rabbit hole goes. Yeah. And okay. It was a deep one.
Yeah, so it was an immersive exploration. But yeah. It does seem to me that in a way, it is impossible to kind of write or talk or photograph these things unless you're immersed in it yourself. There are certain things about it which you can only kind of experience unless you actually experience it.
Of course,
you don't know what it is, and there's a kind of an effective sense of the images, but there's also a sense of the act of urban exploring, like skateboarding, like mudlarking, like I'm sure if you're a policeman or a policewoman chasing after someone down the street, the exhilaration of the chase. Yeah. These things only become apparent actually in the act itself,
yeah,
and you need to be part of that.
Well, absolutely. In your book on skateboarding, the passages which you know are most evocative are the ones where you're talking about the sort of act of skateboarding and what it feels like to have that body technology city assemblage when everything comes together and you're moving through the city and feeling the way it flows and the way it operates, and you're feeling that through the body. And if you hadn't been a skateboarder, you wouldn't know what that feels like.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, but I didn't write it that way, but interesting, when I wrote that book, I didn't write it that way. I wrote it much more, there are bits of it that do that, but the whole kind of construct of it is much more of a traditional history. Hmm. This, I think, is a much more innovative way of talking about a practice, because it's in a, you know, you're kind of with you in a space and time. It starts off with a very dramatic moment of you being arrested at the air